Okay, so hello everybody, and welcome to the sutta class for today. And for today's class, we're going to be looking at Majjhima Nikaya number 152, the Indriya Bhavana Sutta, the development of the faculties. Talking, as with all the suttas in this chapter, talking about the six senses, samayatana, and again, as with all the suttas in this chapter, having a parallel in the Salayatana Sanyutta of the Sarvastivadin Sanyukta Agama preserved in the Chinese translation, and not having any parallels elsewhere in the Majjhima or anywhere else. This particular one, however, also has a few fragments preserved in Sanskrit from the findings in Turfan. Okay, let's have a look at the sutta. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in Kajangala in a grove of Mukelu trees. One of the interesting things, this is a very unusual kind of location. If you look in the version we have here, we have Gajangala instead of, Wikibodhi has Kajangala. So we have a different spelling there. And we also have the Suweluwane. In the beautiful bamboo grove, whereas this one has the in a grove of Mukelu trees. So we have Mukelu rather than that's quite different. Analio notes this in his comparative study. In the Burmese version, we have the Suwelu grove at Gajangala. The Sinhalese version has the Mukelu grove at Kajangala. And the Thai edition has a Veluwana, a bamboo grove at Gajangala. And in the one of the Sanskrit fragments, we have fragments which probably spell something like Ingalayang. So there seems to be considerable confusion as to the actual location of this. The Chinese parallel seems to be similar to the location as given here in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. According to the Vinaya, Kajangala, if this is indeed Kajangala, formed the eastern boundary of the middle country. So, if that's the case, then this would have been to the very far east of the Buddha's journeys. And we've looked at the map a number of times, but this would be Kajangala would be something like. If Magadha is here, Rajagaha, the last discourse is in Rajagaha, Mithila Kapilavattu Savatthi, so the Buddha's main area of wandering was around here, occasionally going up as far as the Kuru country up here, and occasionally going down as far as Avanti down here, down the southern road. Occasionally going up the northern road, and occasionally going down the southern road. And this one, if it's on the easternmost boundary of the middle country, then we have here Anga and Champa. This is the normal sort of easternmost lands that the Buddha sort of went to. And so probably somewhat further east than that, around about here, would have been probably where the discourse was. And again, if it was really so remote, then that might explain why there's a bit of confusion about the names, yeah? And perhaps it wasn't a very well-known place, and there might have been a different dialect might have even been spoken there, which might account for some of the confusion in the name. Okay. Then the Brahman student Uttara, a pupil of the Brahman Parasarya, went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down on one side. The Blessed One then asked him, Uttara, does the Brahman Parasarya teach his disciples the development of the faculties, Indriya Bhavana? He does, Master Gautama. But, Uttara, how does he teach his disciples the development of the faculties? Here, Master Gautama, one does not see forms with the eye. One does not hear sounds with the ear. That is how the Brahman Parasarya teaches his disciples the development of the faculties. If that is so, Uttara, then a blind man and a deaf man will have developed faculties according to what the Brahman Parasarya says. For a blind man does not see forms with the eye, and a deaf man does not hear sounds with the ear. When this was said, the Brahman student Uttara, Parasarya's pupil, sat silent, dismayed, with shoulders drooping and head down, glum and without response. It was a fairly easy takedown, though, wasn't it? I mean, he was asking for it, really. He couldn't have resisted. But he's obviously quite emotionally invested in that. And who knows? Could well have been the case that Uttara didn't really understood the Parasarya's teaching. I'm not aware of any particular teaching like that in the Brahman scriptures. So, anyway, knowing this, the Blessed One addressed the Venerable Ananda. Ananda, the Brahman Parasarya teaches his pupils the development of the faculties in one way, but in the Noble One's disciple, the Arya Vinaya, the supreme development of the faculties is otherwise. Now is the time, Blessed One. Now is the time, Sublime One, for the Blessed One to teach the supreme development of the faculties in the Noble One's discipline. Having heard it from the Blessed One, the bhikkhus will remember it. Then listen, Ananda, and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, Venerable Sir, he replied, and the Blessed One said this. Now, Ananda, how is there the supreme development of the faculties in the Noble One's discipline? Here, Ananda, when a bhikkhu sees a form with the eye, there arises in him what is agreeable, there arises what is disagreeable, there arises what is both agreeable and disagreeable. He understands thus, there has arisen in me what is agreeable, there has arisen in me what is disagreeable, and what is both agreeable and disagreeable. But that is conditioned, gross, dependently arisen. And this is peaceful, this is sublime, that is equanimity. The agreeable that arose, the disagreeable that arose, and the both agreeable and disagreeable that arose cease in him, and equanimity is established. Just as a man with good sight, having opened his eyes, might shut them, or having shut his eyes, might open them, so too concerning anything at all, the agreeable, the disagreeable, or the both agreeable and disagreeable that arose cease just as quickly, just as rapidly, just as easily, and equanimity is established. This is called in the Noble One's disciple, this is a Noble One's discipline, the supreme development of the faculties regarding forms cognizable by the eye. Interesting, I mean, what's interesting about that is that the Buddha's emphasis on the ease of being able to do it, yeah? Just as easy as being able to open your eyes or close your eyes. And the same way that you can establish equanimity regarding things that you're seeing. So he's saying that, so in using that simile, I'm not aware of that particular simile being used in this context elsewhere. So he's clearly drawing on Uttara's earlier statement about the blind person having developed faculties. But in reality, of course, we have developed faculties in our senses which actually we learn from and which we use and so on, but we have a control over them. So you can open and shut your eyes. It's not that you're blind, but you can look if you want to or don't look if you don't want to. And so the same way spiritually, that when you're developing your mind and trying to overcome unwholesome tendencies in your mind, that you have just as much ability to be able to let go of those things just as rapidly, just as easily, and establish equanimity. A So too, when a bhikkhu hears a sound with his ear, there arises what's agreeable and disagreeable and so on. He understands thus, equanimity is established. Just like a strong man might easily snap his fingers, so too concerning anything at all, the agreeable or disagreeable that arose cease just as quickly, just as rapidly, just as easily, and equanimity is established. This is the supreme development of the faculties regarding sounds cognizable by the ear. And similarly, when smelling an odour with the nose, he will establish equanimity just like raindrops on a slightly sloping lotus leaf roll off and do not remain there. So too, concerning anything at all, agreeable or disagreeable, or both agreeable and disagreeable that arose, they cease just as quickly. Now it seems clear that the first two similes are connected with the relevant senses. You know, the simile about the visual restraint is connected with opening and shutting your eyes. The simile about the restraint of the ears is connected with the clicking of your fingers. So I wonder whether the lotus idea is the smell of the lotus. That's why it's connected with the sense of smell. Yeah? So you abandon the delightful smell of the lotus just like it would fall off. I guess. Makes sense. Okay. Again, Ananda, when a bhikkhu tastes the flavour with the tongue, there arises in him what's agreeable, what's disagreeable, both agreeable and disagreeable. He understands thus an equanimity is established. Just as a strong man might easily spit out a ball of spittle collected on the tip of his tongue, so too concerning anything at all, he establishes equanimity. This is the supreme development of the faculties regarding flavours cognizable by the tongue. Again, Ananda, when a bhikkhu touches a tangible with the body, he establishes equanimity just as if a strong man might extend his flexed arm or flex his extended arm. So too, the equanimity is established just as easily. Again, Ananda, when a bhikkhu cognizes a mind object with the mind, there arises in what's agreeable, what's disagreeable, what's both agreeable and disagreeable. He understands this and establishes the equanimity just as if a man were to let two or three drops of water fall on an iron plate heated for a whole day. The falling of the drops might be slow, but they would quickly vaporize and vanish. So too, concerning anything at all, the agreeable that arose, the disagreeable that arose, the both agreeable and disagreeable that arose, cease just as quickly, just as rapidly, just as easily, and equanimity is established. This is called, in the Noble One's discipline, the supreme development of the faculties regarding ideas cognizable by the mind. And that's how there is the supreme development of the faculties in the Noble One's discipline. Okay, so I'll go from there over to the comparative study, and we'll have a look at how the Chinese one might be similar or differ. Does anyone have any questions so far? So have a look at some of the Pali terms here. Interesting detail. The blind person is the Andho, and the deaf person is Badhiro. Deaf, that not being a word that's very common. Blind one is fairly common, but deaf, Badhiro. A bad hero. Badhiro. Okay, so... Yeah, I'm coming to it. One second. Okay, so here's the agreeable, manapa. Amanapa, upanang, manapa. It's, very closely related, yeah. But Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation is good enough. It's agreeable, but more, it basically means pleasant. Yeah. Wish for desirable. Desirable might be better. Desired, amanapa, undesirable, both desirable and undesirable. But that is conditioned. coarse and penitently originated. And this is peaceful, this is sublime, that is to say, equanimity. It's quite a high praise of equanimity, really, because, I mean, the Buddha, that particular phrase, etang santang, etang panitang, would he usually use for nibbana. But this is obviously talking about quite a high development of equanimity. The Buddha says it's the Aryasavinaya Anuttara Indriya Bhavana, the unexcelled development of the faculties in the Noble One's discipline. Okay. Next. Okay, so to the parallel comparative study from Venerable Analia's text. The Indriya Bhavana Sutta and its Sanyukta Agama parallel report in similar ways that the Brahman youth Uttara, on being asked how he had been instructed with regard to the development of the faculties, explained that his teacher recommended to avoid seeing forms with the eye and hearing sounds with the ear. In both versions, this proposal meets with the rebuttal that in this case the blind and deaf would be accomplished practitioners. A slight difference is that in the Pali version, only the Buddha mentioned the blind one, whereas the Ananda brought up the deaf person. The Uttara's silent dismay on hearing the Buddha's reply is not mentioned in the Sanyukta Agama version. And this introductory narration, interestingly enough, also recurs as a discourse quotation in the Vibhasha translation. So this is the Vibhasha is the great Sarvastivadin commentarial text, which agree with the Sanyukta Agama version, as one would expect, because the Sanyukta Agama is also Sarvastivadin. They agree with that this remark about the deaf was made by Ananda. And Analia further goes on to note that Bronkhorst, in an essay in 1993, sees a contradiction between this criticism of the development of the faculty through avoiding sights and sounds proposed by Uttara's teacher and the approving attitude shown in other discourses toward deeper states of concentration during which sights and sounds are no longer experienced. Yet the point made in the present discourse is how to relate to everyday experience. In fact, the expression development of the faculties, Indriya Bhavana, is an obvious counterpart to restraint of the factories, or even the faculties, Indriya Sangvara. Thus, the present passage is not a criticism of deeper states of concentration through which sensory experience is absent, but rather a criticism of attempting to deal with sensory impact during daily life by simply trying to avoid it, instead of developing equanimity towards whatever is experienced. I just kind of make a note of that, because that's an argument which you do hear from time to time, and to me, it's quite astonishing. As you all know, I've studied and learnt a lot, and have a lot of respect for people, scholars who do take the Buddha's teaching seriously and put a lot of time into it. But I also find it frequently and normally completely astonishing how that they can completely mess up very simple and obvious things. I mean, it seems to me that's a completely obvious point. This is not talking about a deep state of meditation. It's obviously talking about, like we said, mentioned in the previous sutta, going for alms round or something like that. So for Bronkhorst, who is in many ways a great scholar, to make that kind of elementary mistake really is quite telling. And that kind of mistake is, you find it very often in scholars and people who are not actually practicing the Dhamma. So it's important to bear that in mind. And the reason for mentioning it is not to particularly criticize Bronkhorst, or even particularly because it's a very important point. I don't think anybody here would make that same mistake. But the important thing to do is to bear it in mind that when you're reading scholarly work on Buddhism, even though we can learn things from it, but just to maintain a bit of a critical eye with it, that remember that most of the scholars are not meditators. Some are. But there's just as many silly ideas that you find in scholastic circles as you find anywhere else. And they sort of somehow get traction because, I don't know, where they were published or the influence of the author and so on. And you shouldn't feel inadequate or you shouldn't feel sort of timid to challenge those kinds of ideas when they come up. Well, he notes that in this case, the Buddha criticizes the idea that that sense restraint means you don't see and hear things, whereas other places in the sutra it seems to praise deep states of meditation where you don't see or hear things. And so Bronkhorst seems to think that that's a contradiction. So like in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, for example, where the Buddha's sitting and then doesn't hear the sound of the lightning storm and so on. And so Bronkhorst thought that that was a contradiction, whereas in fact fairly obviously they're talking about two quite different things. Yeah. Bronkhorst is one of the, he's a German scholar, but he's one of the ones who's done research in specifically into meditation states in early Buddhism and how they relate to Jaina practices and so on. Part of the context of that argument was noticing the difference between the Buddhist and Jaina approach to sense restraint and these kinds of things, which is actually along the lines of what you see here, right? The Buddhist approach is always knowing how to deal skillfully and respond to sense response, whereas the Jain attitude obviously is quite different. Okay, so moving on. Following a request by Ananda, so back to Venerable Analio's comparative study, the Buddha then expounded his approach to the development of the faculties. In both discourses, this approach covers three aspects, though the two versions present these three aspects in a different sequence and under different headings. The first of these three aspects in the Pali version is the supreme development of the faculties, Anuttara Indriya Bhavana, which depicts how to establish equanimity in regard to sense experience that's agreeable, disagreeable, and both agreeable and disagreeable. In each case, one should know that such experiences are conditioned and gross, whereas equanimity is refined and peaceful. The Pali version applies the same to each of the six senses and depicts this way of handling experience at each sense door with a set of similes. These similes illustrate the swift establishing of equanimity at each sense door in the following manner, as we've already seen. And the eye is opening, closing the eyes, ear is snapping one's fingers, the nose is water rolling off a lotus leaf, the tongue is spitting out a gob of spit, the body is flexing or stretching one's arm, and the mind is water dropping onto a heated plate and evaporating quickly. The Sanghupta Agama version has a similar treatment, the actual teaching is very similar, but in its Sanghupta it's the second topic, not the first topic, although it introduces this under the heading of being, a different heading of being a noble one with developed faculties, rather than being the unexcelled development of the faculties. The Sanghupta Agama version's presentation also differs in its use of the image of water drops that fall into a heated pan, as it employs this simile to illustrate the establishment of equanimity at the body sense door, while the Majjhima Nikaya applies this to the mind. In the case of establishing equanimity at the mind sense door, the Sanghupta Agama instead uses the example of beheading a palmyra tree, a palm tree. It's interesting. Yeah, certainly it's less obvious how that one relates directly to the mind. I mean, yeah, water drops falling onto a hot plate and getting evaporated, if you like. Yes, of course you can use that as an analogy for the mind, but it's not so obvious why it's the mind specifically. Venerable Analia has quite a long and interesting footnote here about the establishment of equanimity in regard to pleasant or unpleasant experiences, and a counterpart to this is found in the Jaina text, the Ayaranga, which instructs to avoid being attached to or developing any desire towards agreeable or disagreeable sense experiences. He gives the text here from Watanabe, which actually is quite interesting for someone studying Pali. But anyway, the text in Arutamagadhi, and the translation is, if a creature with ears hears agreeable and disagreeable sounds, it should not be attached to or delighted with nor desiring of nor infatuated nor covetous of nor disturbed by the agreeable or disagreeable sounds. The text continues by pointing out that given that it is not possible to avoid hearing sounds, a monk should avoid desire or aversion towards them. Okay, so it says na sakka na song sadda. So it's not possible to avoid hearing sounds. And Watanabe, the Japanese scholar who edited the text, notes that the title of the treatment is Bhavana, being similar to the current text in the Pali. Compared to the Pali version, the difference is that the Jain text begins its treatment with what is heard through the ear before turning to what's seen through the eye, the nose, the tongue, the body, a difference which is a recurrent feature in Jaina texts. Okay, so the Jain texts usually start with the ear instead of the eye, which is kind of a curious difference. If you look at the similar listings of the senses in the Upanishads and Brahmanical texts, there doesn't seem to be a standard list in the early period, pre-Buddhist period, and indeed you don't find you find the senses kind of mixed up with other things in curious ways, like say the senses will be in a list along with, you know, you have eye, ear, nose, tongue, breath, intention, faith, volition, body, and so on, all in one list. So there's not the same clarity, conceptual, categorical clarity that you find in the Pali texts. Of course, you find that later on, but not in the early Upanishads. Going back to an earlier footnote here about the Jain text, is explained by another scholar, McHugh, probably reflecting Jain cosmology, whereas the Buddhist sequence appears to be based on analysis of the nature of perception, based on the relation between the perceiver and the perceived, the eye being given pride of place due to its being the most far-reaching organ. I mean, I think that's interesting, and I think there are interesting reasons why the eye is always first in Buddhist texts. I think there's something more fundamental to it rather than it's just being the most far-reaching. I mean, yes, it is the most far-reaching, but I think there's something much more ingrained about us, and possibly about higher mammals or primates, is that sight is our, you know, our dominant sense. I mean, we have moved our eyes to the front of our head, developed 3D vision, and there's something I think very powerful about the notion of light, of light meaning knowing. When the dawn comes up, and if you're in the darkness in the forest, then you know things, you can see things, you understand things, and then darkness meaning ignorance. And I think that's hardwired into the human brain at a fundamental evolutionary level. But there is that difference. So the Jain text on the sense restraint is very similar to the Pali, but do notice that slight difference also. It says that because it's not possible to not hear sounds or see sights, where the Jain text is sort of almost like saying, well, we kind of really wish that it was possible, right? The world would be a better place if we never had to see or hear anything, whereas you don't really find that in Buddhism. And elsewhere, of course, in Jaina texts, that the having sense experience is, of course, the result of karma, which is to be burnt off. And so you sort of deliberately subject yourself to painful sense experience in order to burn off your past karma. Okay. Okay, so sequence of ideas that we find in the two versions. So in the Pali version, we have the first one is equanimity, the sense experience. Second one is disgust. And see agreeable, and that we're going to be moving on to these ones. We haven't seen them yet. See agreeable as disagreeable. So that's the sequence in the Pali. And the sequence in the Sarvastivadin version is is number one is agreeable and disagreeable. Number two is equanimity. Number three. Okay, so that's the different sequences in the two suttas. Okay, so the part we've looked at this first section, the equanimity, which is the first in the Pali and the second in the Sarasivada, and we're about to go on to the other two sections.
I find it kind of a little bit problematic.
Uh-huh.
Because you should go into the package.
Uh-huh.
Because usually with a beginner mind, in your training, it's quite around the aversion that it works with the defilement may arise in the mind, or potential defilement may arise in the mind. So for the beginner, usually the skill is worth it, but if you're averse to it. But with your higher development, with the until pressure of development, the practitioner may use the reasoning and she is agreeable. It's called Ariya Iti. So, and at the end of it, is one doesn't even need to use the reasoning anymore, but to view it and she wanted to
Right. Okay. Very good. Yeah. I also would agree that's a the sequence is somewhat problematic. So you're suggesting that we have a sequence like this, the Dhammananda sequence, and the last one is equanimity, something like that. Is that what you're suggesting? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would agree that would seem more logical. And certainly it's normally the case that equanimity is usually the last thing, it's the outcome, yeah? And the Buddha says this is the anuttara indriya bhavana, yeah? This is the highest development of the faculties, again, which would suggest that it should be the last one, just like the fourth jhana is the anuttara citta, is the unexcelled mind. So let's go on a bit further and let's see what the comparative, what the sutta says and what the comparative study says. And we'll see whether that sheds any more light on this. Okay. How, Ananda, is one a disciple in higher training, one who has entered upon the way? Here, Ananda, when a bhikkhu sees a form with an eye, hears sound with the ear, smells an odour with the nose, tastes a flavour with the tongue, touches a tangible with body, cognizes a mind object with mind. And by the way, the Pali Sutta has never addressed the question of synesthesia, which would be an interesting one here. A bhikkhu sees a form with the ear, hears a sound with the eye. Anyway, there arises in him what is agreeable, what is disagreeable, both agreeable and disagreeable. He's ashamed, humiliated, and disgusted by the agreeable that arose, by the disagreeable that arose, and by the both agreeable and disagreeable that arose. Okay, so so that's quite a strong reaction. Okay, so the explanation that Bhikkhu Bodhi gives is that the seka, the one who's on the higher training, so this of course refers to a stream enterer or higher, stream enterer, once returner or non-returner, he's still prone to subtle states of liking, aversion and dull indifference in regard to sense objects. He experiences these, however, as impediments to his progress and thus becomes repelled, humiliated and disgusted by them. And how, Ananda, is a noble one with developed faculties? Here, Ananda, when a bhikkhu sees a form with the eye, he hears a sound with the ear, smells an odour with the nose or tastes a flavour with the tongue or touches a tangible with the body, cognizes a mind object with the mind, there arises in him what's agreeable, what's disagreeable, what would be both agreeable and disagreeable. If he should wish, may I abide perceiving the unrepulsive in the repulsive. He abides perceiving the unrepulsive in the repulsive. If you should wish, may I abide perceiving the repulsive in the unrepulsive. He abides perceiving the repulsive in the unrepulsive. That may I abide perceiving the unrepulsive in the repulsive and the unrepulsive. He abides perceiving the repulsive in the unrepulsive and the repulsive. And if he wishes, may I abide perceiving the... May I abide perceiving the repulsive in the unrepulsive and the repulsive. So you can see the... And then if he should wish, may I, avoiding both the repulsive and unrepulsive, abide in equanimity, mindful and fully aware. He abides in equanimity towards that, mindful and fully aware. That is how one is a noble one with developed faculties. Okay, so in this particular one, you're developing more like a sort of a conscious wish to be able to see things in different ways. So you can, if something's attractive to you, you can look on the bad side of it and see it as repulsive. So you know, if I think with nostalgia back to my days of fame and glory as a rock god, then I can think of the reality of the smell of the carpet in the pub on a hot afternoon when you come in to set up for the sound check. And that's usually somewhat effective. And so similarly, if something's disagreeable, then you can think of that as agreeable. And so, you know, you do that, for example, if there's maybe, say, a person who you find very annoying, gets on your nerves, then you can reflect to yourself, okay, well, look, this person is suffering, or this person has, you know, different good qualities, and so on and so forth. And by reflecting on that way, then you overcome that sense of aversion, and so on for the different kinds of one. And of course, the highest, as we noted before, the highest is simply to have the equanimity, where you avoid those kinds of responses completely.
But isn't it this one you say at the end that this is one with somebody who already developed?
A noble one with developed faculties, yeah.
So it's like someone already developed rather than just a student.
Right, yeah. So that certainly sounds like it's talking about an arahant. Normally a noble one with developed faculties would assume that it would be an arahant, but it's saying that there arises what's agreeable and disagreeable. It sounds like they've got, you know, desire and hatred towards things. But before we go on to make too much conclusion about that, remember that the headings is one of the things which is different in the Chinese version. So let's have a look and see how that differs before going to drawing too much conclusions from that. So the Madhyama Nikaya version next turns to the disciple in higher training. On the path, it becomes, this is again back to Anadyo's comparative study, the disciple in higher training on the path who becomes disgusted with sense experience, and the Sanyukta Agama version has a similar treatment as the last of its three topics. Okay, again, see this sequence. And the third and last topic in the Majjhima Nikaya version is to be a noble one with developed faculties, which requires one to be able to view the agreeable as disagreeable, the disagreeable as agreeable, etc., and to go beyond what is agreeable or disagreeable and dwell in equanimity. Elsewhere, this practice is called the Arya Iddhi. This practice is taught elsewhere in the suttas and in Guttara 5s. And in the Patisambhita Magga is called the Arya Iddhi, the Noble One's psychic power. The corresponding treatment in the Chinese and Sanyukta Agama version discourse is the first of the three topics to be taken up, introduced under the heading "The Supreme Development of the Faculties," which, of course, in the Pali is the heading used for the first one, equanimity. The Sanyukta Agama version differs from the corresponding treatment in the Majjhima Nikaya discourse by having the Buddha as its object, having a Buddha as its subject, and by working through a somewhat different pattern. This pattern is as follows. So this is the Chinese version. Repulsion towards pleasing objects, no repulsion towards displeasing object, repulsion and no repulsion towards pleasing and displeasing, no repulsion and repulsion towards displeasing and pleasing, and equanimity towards pleasing, displeasing and pleasing and displeasing objects. And I'm sure you've got all that. And the Pali is somewhat different. So in sum, underlying the overall pattern of the Indriya Bhavana Sutta, a gradual build-up may be discerned, which proceeds through the following topics. Initial insight into the conditioned nature of sensory input experiences, agreeable and disagreeable. Discuss with this evaluative mode of experiencing sensory data the disciple in higher training, and the full mastery of reactions in regard to sense experience by an accomplished one who has fully developed his faculties. And the Nalaya notes another a couple of suttas which are parallel to this. The pattern in the Sanyukta Agama version instead does not seem to have such an underlying progression. Its main steps are in brief the stage of the Tathagata, the development of the faculties, and the discussed with sense experience of the disciple in higher training. From the viewpoint of textual transmission, says Venerable Nalaya, it is noteworthy that both versions begin with the supreme development of the faculties as their first topic, although they differ on what type of treatment should be associated with this heading. While the Majjhima Nikaya version presents a set of similes illustrative of the establishment of equanimity at each sense door under the supreme development of the faculties, the Sanyukta Agama version makes use of a similar set of similes when examining the noble one with developed faculties. The supreme development of the faculties in the Sanyukta Agama discourse then develops the Majjhima Nikaya's exposition of how to be a noble one with developed faculties. And so notice that the Analio suggested way of progress is similar to Venerable Dhammananda's suggestion here. Hence, although the two versions agree on beginning their overall treatment with the same heading as the first of three topics, during the course of transmission, a whole section has apparently been displaced within the discourse and has been separated from its original heading. In spite of this displacement, the presentation in both versions is similar, a treatment that both conclude with an emphatic exhortation by the Buddha to meditate and thereby put his teaching into practice. We haven't read that bit yet. So the finishing off. So, and under the supreme development of the faculties in the noble one's discipline has been taught by me, the disciple in higher training who has entered upon the way has been taught by me, and the noble one with developed faculties has been taught by me. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them, that I have done for you, Ananda. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate, Ananda, do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. That's what the Blessed One said. Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. And so I hardly imagine that it's a coincidence that these are the last words in the Majjhima Nikaya.
And the word meditate, what is that in
Pali? Jayata. Etani ananda rukamulani, etani sunyagarani, jhayatananda. Practice jhanas, ma pamarata, do not be negligent. Ma pacha vipatisarino ahu vata, do not regret it later. Ayam wo amhakang anusasanandi. This is our dispensation to you. Yeah. So Analia concludes his essay here. Due to their similarities and differences, the Pali Indriya Bhavana Sutta and its Sanyukta Agama parallel, in a way, form a fitting conclusion to this series of comparative studies. Comparison of these two versions shows that at least one of them has suffered from a substantial sequential alteration during transmission. This alteration not only has caused a change in the overall sequence, but has also resulted in associating the three main parts of the exposition with different headings. At the same time, in spite of their variations, the Pali Indriya Bhavana Sutta and its Sanyukta Agama parallel present closely similar teachings. And of course, this being the pattern which we've seen repeated countless times, when I say countless times, I mean precisely 152 times in the Majjhima Nikaya, that the suttas do differ sometimes in the sequence and details, but the overall teachings is the same. I do have to say that my overall impression is that this particular Wagga, this Salayatana Wagga, seems to be more different, more variant compared to the Chinese on average than most of the other suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, and I would attribute that to, as I mentioned before, the suggestion that it was originally a group of 10 suttas in the Samyukta Agama, which was taken out of there and padded out to become big and diverse enough to have a place in the Majjhima Nikaya. And during that process, certain confusions and changes and so on happened. But even in that case, there's hardly any, if any at all, significant doctrinal changes. It's merely a matter of the change in the sequence and sometimes the particular content of what's included in one sutta or another sutta. They use it for lamps, burning and shining, which also have similar, but they have a similar meaning. I wouldn't actually say that that's a literal meaning. They're actually different roots, which have the same, they share the same form in Pali, but in Sanskrit they're different roots. The root jhana actually originally had a, as far as I can trace, the root of jhana is dhi in the Vedas, which had a meaning of something like dhi had a meaning of almost like prayer, uplifted thought. What do you want to search? The ultimate Pali root is D, which I don't think we're going to get. Sanskrit with D. Here we go. Veda base. There you go. Excellent. So this is this is great. This is the actual. Okay, so these are from the Shatapatha Brahmana and the BG, whatever BG is, Bhagavad Gita. Oh, so that's quite late. But it's found quite commonly in the Vedas. I'm not sure why we're not getting Vedic ones here. Dhi mata, very intelligent. Dhi matang, those endowed with great wisdom. Sarva dhi vritti, process of realization by all sorts of intelligence. So they're translating dhi here as intelligence. So this is in the Bhagavad Gita and the Shatapatha Brahmana. Jaladhi, by oceans. Dhi for the intelligence. Mana sarira dhi. D mate, the intelligent, Piety from the ocean of milk. Interesting, there's a milk connection coming in here. Ocean connection. Maybe that's probably a different word though. It looks like it's a short I. Dhiman, intelligent, functioning of the mind. Intelligent. So, in these texts, the Shatapada Brahmana is pre-Buddhist. What's this one? Sri Chaitanya. Must be a later text of some kind. Then it's translating here as intelligence. Which is somewhat missing the point a little bit. It often has an uplifting sense, and the greatest context of that is the Gayatri. So the Gayatri is one of the most popular of all the mantras used in Hinduism, still very popular today. And one of the relatively small number of elements of Hinduism which is actually traceable back to the Vedas, I believe. So the Gayatri, Om Purbhuva Swah Tatsavitur Varenyang Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi Dhiyo Yonah Prachodayat, which means Ambuhur Burvaswa is homage to the earth, the ground, the being, and the heavens. Tat Savitur Varenyang, that glorious rising sun, Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi, Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi is the who illuminates, yeah, but I'm trying to translate Bhargo Devasya. Here's, Devasya is a divine who illuminates with divine intelligence, the Dhima, sorry? Brilliance, something like that, brilliance is good. Dhyo Yonah Prachodayat. So, and who's Dhi. Right, so this is the root, the same root as jhana comes from, whose intelligence, but intelligence is not really adequate, whose brilliance, whose is impelling. So this is where prachodayat is to impel or to uplift. So it's like saying, the idea is that it's like a homage to the sun which is rising, and which is, it's like this, the infinite glory of the rising sun inspires our mind towards illumination. Something like that is what it's saying. Yeah?
The symbol of the Bodhisattva, wisdom, magician is the...
Okay. Yeah, which may or may not be related. Quite possibly is, yeah.
So, the is the root of jhana?
And that's the root of the word jhana, yeah.
So you're saying that it's not just burning, but it's...
No. Burning is actually a separate root in Sanskrit. They just happen to have the same form in Pali. Yeah, it doesn't actually etymologically have anything to do with burning. It's just a coincidence.
So the explanation that it's actually is burning the defilements of Sanskrit.
Well, that's just an etymological explanation, but it's not the actual etymology of it. Yeah. It is. Yeah. You can make some research.
How do you know it is?
Oh, look, it's a well-studied, highly well-known technical term in the Vedas and Indian stuff, and it has a very straightforward etymology from D to dhyana. In Sanskrit, is dhyana, and the I becomes a Y, and so etymologically, it's very straightforward. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, the root ja is root for jhana in Pali, but the Sanskrit root is from, of course, dhyana, and dhyana comes from the root dhi. Yeah. Dhi, Proto-Indo-Aryan verb. Oh, here we have Proto-Indo-Aryan. Oh, excellent. So here's the Proto-Indo-European Sanskrit verb dhyai, Proto-Indian Indo-European verb dhi, Sanskrit dhyai or dhyai. Curious. It's just thinking to itself. So it's giving a Proto-Indo-European root for it. Let's see if. If there's anything in the Pali dictionary. From Jayati, Buddhist Sanskrit, dhyana. The popular etymology is given by Buddhaghosa as it's called jhana from its meditation on objects and from burning up anything adverse. So because it burns up. Sorry? Okay, so it gives various things, but it doesn't give anything about the etymology.
Jayati does.
I think gives more details of that. Dhyayati, Sanskrit, dhyayati, dhi, dhira, dhi, from dhi deity, shine, perceive. He says he's cunning, meaning to meditate, contemplate, think over, brood over. In the next century. Jayati 2, Sanskrit kshayati, to burn, kshayakshi, karakcharika, to burn, to be on fire, to be consumed, to waste away, to dry up, jalayati, jayati, and so on. So, it's etymologically, it's two different words from two different roots. It's quite inaccurate, yes. No, that's what we've just shown, that there are two different etymologies, are. The word jhana doesn't have anything to do with burning up, but it's just used as a pun in the Pali, but it's not an actual etymology.
So it's the same root as dhira?
Dhira, yeah. Right.
So we're meditating here, like
you are. Absolutely.
Yeah.
See if there's anything in the the usage of it in the in the Vedas is extremely interesting, actually. Because it because it does have this meaning of does have this sense, like you see in the Gayatri Mantra, where you give me no matches for D. It's ridiculous. Thank you very much. It does have a it has this very much the sense of of a mind state which is developed, like a pure sort of exalted mind state which is to be developed. These associations with light, like it's even in that sense, it's not literally meaning burning, but it's still associated with the sun. And the sun is that which is impelling the brightness and the clarity of consciousness. So it's like saying this sun is our inspiration. And so it's like the kind of the day is made magical and is made spiritual by the inspiration of the sun, which is raising up our dhi. And so it still very much has this kind of idea of the connection with the mental development, which is such an important intrinsic part of the Pali term. Mercy is giving us everything. That's ridiculous. Mercy is giving us everything. Substring. Prefix. Da, da, da. That's a bit better. That's still not good. Americans exact don't give us anything. Let me fix. I don't know how to get a proper. Maybe it's just listed under Tiana. So here's the Sanskrit dictionary. Dihata dihana and the root dihai. Thinking. Thinking, meditation. So thinking, meditation. So in Sanskrit always has that. So different one. Dihai. So again, this is root here, dhyayati, dhyay, and so on. To think of, imagine, contemplate, meditate on, call to mind, recollect. So still strongly connected with all of these mental terms, manasa, chetasa, hridaya, and so on. To brood mischief against. Yeah? Yeah, you find... Yes, that's a particular kind of meditation, which... yes, that's true. You find occasionally these kind of negative ideas of dhyana. So let the head hang down, instead of an animal, dhyayati. Yeah. So, in the Pali, you find like the animals, the donkeys meditating on its food. So dhyana, dhyata, merely thought of dhyata metta. No, it's not as inspiring. No. Dhyana, meditation, thought, reflection, especially profound and abstract religious meditation, blah, 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 with Buddhists divided into four stages. That's going to give us. That's good. There's an actual text. What's that giving us? Dharma Sangraha. Yeah, you do find the four. Jhana is mentioned occasionally in Hinduism, but not really a standard group. Anyway, so that's that. So anyway, the upshot of all that etymology is meditation is a good thing and you should do lots of it. So regardless of the etymology, that still remains the same, yes.
But the root itself doesn't definitely prove that we're referring to the four stages of knowledge, jhana.
Sure.
Could, I mean, the root does suggest such a broader sense of...
Oh, definitely, yeah. Definitely, yeah, and it historically was used that way and is used occasionally in the Pali in that way. But, you know, most of the time, of course, in Pali, it's definitely, I think it was the Buddha who restricted the usage mostly specifically to that group of four jhanas. You don't find the four jhanas mentioned as such in any pre-Buddhist texts. You do find them referred to once or twice in things like the Mahabharata. But then the Mahabharata, by its own admission, tries to include everything it possibly can. But definitely in an earlier time, it seems like in the Vedas it had this sense of the inspired thought, like a spiritual or uplifting thought, which is already quite interesting because there was an in-depth study of that by a lady called Velkar, I believe. I think the book is in the Buddhist library, perhaps. Anyway, I borrowed the book from somewhere. What she was showing was that even in the earlier stages of the Vedas, that even though the Vedas are often said to be purely about ritual and so on and not to have any meditative or contemplative aspect to them, but she showed, I think, quite clearly that there was quite a strong and profound reflective and contemplative aspect in the Vedas, not to mention the later Upanishads and so on, but even in the Rig Veda itself. And one of the main words was this word dhi, which is already clearly being used in the sense of a mental state which is to be developed through doing spiritual practices. And, you know, mentioned many times and emphasized quite strongly. That's the seeds, at least of one aspect of meditation, are already present there within the Rig Veda.
Yeah,
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, of course, yeah. That's right. I mean, of course, he always adapted the meaning and changed it according to his own. He was never trapped in the usage. He was very conscious how he used words and would redefine things very often according to his own meaning. But the interesting thing is not, to me, the interesting thing is not the difference, because of course there's a difference. But to me, the interesting thing is that, like, if you look at comparable literature to the Vedas, in term, if you look, say, at the Iliad and the Odyssey, for example, the Iliad, even the Odyssey is much later, but the Iliad is of a comparable date to the Rig Veda. And there's almost no recognition or mention of mental states at all in the Iliad. And certainly no idea that there's like a contemplative or religious dimension to spiritual or to religious life, which you can develop through contemplative practices. So that idea is completely absent from anything like the Iliad or any other Western scriptures. Even though they're both drawing on the same cosmology, right? So the Rig Veda and the Iliad are both sharing the same Indo-European cosmology and much of the same linguistic basis. But that aspect of it is just completely absent. There's nothing even vaguely like it. To me that's very interesting and curious about how that became introduced in specifically the Indian tradition. Now we've traced the etymology of dhi back to a psychological term, and a psychological term which is already quite a sophisticated psychological term, right? It's not just a word for thought in an ordinary sense, it's a word for a particular kind of mental development that's appropriate within a spiritual sense. And that's already quite a sophisticated idea, and it must have older roots. And it must have a more simple or more basic meaning in older texts, but I haven't come across that. I don't know whether that's traceable, and I don't know whether there's any, like we just saw the Proto-Indo-European roots, and they haven't traced it any further back. Perhaps it just doesn't exist in other forms. If there's no cognates found in English, and I'm not aware that it does have cognate found in English or other Western languages, then perhaps it might even have been adopted from the local Indian languages rather than being Indo-European. One possibility. Anyway. Okay, so with that, any more questions? Okay, so thank you very much for your attendance. And I'd like to bring this final sutta class to a close. So now we've finished the 152 suttas of the Majjhima Nikaya. Sadhu, 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 sadhu. So now we should all go back and read them all again. Okay, and if for, we've been reading from Analio's studies, and we've been reading the sutta excerpts, but also to mention that he does also have excellent introduction and conclusion, which we haven't read. So if you haven't read those, you definitely should, because he draws together a lot of the strands and ideas that have emerged through that massive research project that he undertook. So do yourself a favour. Okay.